Hello and welcome to the Microbiomedics Podcast. I'm Dr. Siobhan McCormack.
And I'm Dr. Sheena Fraser, and we're your co-hosts.
We are both GPs and lifestyle medics with a shared passion for microbiome science, and we have spent the last 5 years deep diving into the world of the gut microbiome.
We've been analysing the evidence, appraising the studies, speaking to the experts, and writing the Gut Microbiome for Clinicians e-learning course for the BSLM Learning Academy.
We have discovered that the gut and other human microbiomes are pivotal to every aspect of your health and physiology, and the pillars of lifestyle medicine hold the key.
So in these Microbiomedic podcasts, we'll be covering the basics, bringing you the latest research and talking to the experts on all matters microbiome.
We'll be translating the evidence and packaging it into actionable, bite-sized chunks so that you can harness the power of the microbiome to improve your own health and that of your patients.
Hello and welcome to today's Microbiomedics podcast and a happy new year to you all. A little bit different today, we're going to have a conversation with some Cheshire kombucha makers, Emma and Kenny. They're founders of Hip Pop, which is an alternative beverage brand. We don't have any affiliation with this brand. We just kind of like what they're doing. And I'm joined as always with Shiv. So how are you doing, Shiv?
I am good. Hi, Sheena. I'm looking forward to this.
I know. And Happy New Year to you, Siobhan. It's been a little while since we chatted. And obviously, we've had the festive period in the meantime. So how have you been?
I am very good. And this episode is really well placed because if any of you listened to the Christmas episode, I gave Sheena a kombucha set for her present. And I suspect it's been incredibly busy. Sheena and I are both GPs, and it's been crazy busy at work. So I suspect, Sheena, have you managed to make any kombucha yet? I suspect not.
Well, I've kind of. I'm actually a little bit stuck, to be honest. So I want to pick your brains on this. So you were very kind, and I got the kombucha SCOBY and everything. And I think what we should do probably first of all is maybe explain to everybody what kombucha is, and then I'll basically kick in with where I'm at with this kombucha making a little bit further down the line. Because Siobhan, I think so many people just don't have a clue what kombucha is and why we're even talking about it. So can you tell everybody what kombucha is and why you gave it to me as a present?
Absolutely. Well, I have to admit, I didn't have a clue what it was until relatively recently. So it is, now I see it everywhere. It's a beverage obtained by fermenting sweetened tea with something called a SCOBY, which we'll go into later. So it's basically microbes plus sweet tea. And they make this incredible drink called kombucha, which is meant to have health promoting properties, but we'll get back to that in a moment. So what is this SCOBY? Well, if you've listened to the podcast, you'll have heard me talk about my SCOBY before. It's this gelatinous alien type jellyfish looking thing that's a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. And what you do is you place that in a glass jar with green tea and some sugar, and you leave it for anything between 2 to 4 to 6 weeks, and it produces this incredible drink that is delicious and health promoting. Now, it's not a new thing. I didn't invent it. It's been consumed in many parts of the world for centuries, both for its taste and because it's been perceived to be beneficial to the health, for your health. There's lots of talk about it being good for cardiovascular system. It reduces cancer risk, infections, mood, diabetes, improves your blood sugar. However, this is the problem with the evidence, because although these things have been proven in animal studies and in culture cell studies, there's been very little or practically zero evidence or studies done in humans on just kombucha. It's a really complex area to investigate and study. And that's why these health benefits are just a hypothesis, really. No one actually knows whether it definitely helps or not. And that's why, there's limitations in what we can say. But we'll talk a bit more about how you make kombucha. But go back a bit, Sheena. So I had never heard of these guys, Emma and Kenny. So maybe just, direct people or explain how you actually met them and where they come from.
Uh-huh. So I was at a festival in the summer, a festival called Solas, and it's in the Perthshire countryside. And it's a tiny little festival. And it's really just got one band stage and it had, little tents for writers to present at. And there was a health and well-being tent. And basically I was contributing to the health and well-being tent, just talking about microbiomes. And I met some really, really interesting people. And while I was there, just before I was going on to talk about microbiomes, somebody came over to me and said, "Hi, I'm part of this kombucha company, and we're really, really interested in you talking about microbiomes because this is what we're really interested in." And it was lovely to meet them. But basically, this festival, they wanted a dry bar. So they wanted a bar that didn't contain alcohol for people as an alternative to the alcohol bar that was there as well. And they provided the drinks for the dry bar. And so they provided a sort of big variety of fermented soft drinks, so kombuchas and a non-kombucha soft drinks that are fermented that they also provided. So really interesting that they were doing this, and I sort of looked into their company after that, and they invited me to talk alongside you, Siobhan, when we were down in Manchester to talk on their social media platform. So it was lovely to meet them and to see what they're doing. And obviously it seemed like an obvious one to do a podcast with them because of what they're actually doing.
I remember you saying two things I want to ask you, Sheena. One is, I remember you really liking them and their product and talking to me about it. And particularly, I just want you to talk about two things. One is the sugar content and where they get the sweetening effect from. And the second is, you say it was a dry bar, but is it not true that there's small amounts of alcohol as part of the fermentation process? And, how does that work if you say it's non-alcoholic?
Yeah, I know. And that's the funny thing about all these sort of fermented drinks, because the fermentation process actually creates a little bit of alcohol. In the same way when, I don't know if you ever made ginger beer when you were a kid, but we used to make ginger beer at home, and it's the same thing. You know, you can create small quantities of alcohol within your ginger beer. So we can't really say that it's fully a soft drink, but it's such a tiny quantity. And certainly in the sort of more commercially driven kombucha making, it really is a negligible amount, and so it's not considered to be alcoholic because it's not enough to call it alcoholic, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think it's so, alcohol free, isn't it? It's considered alcohol free. Yeah,
that's right. So just a tiny. I think if you make it yourself, you might be able to make it a little bit stronger than that. But certainly the commercial stuff is the alcohol free. But yeah, it was interesting to see. And yes, sugar is part of the recipe, isn't it? I mean, the sugar is there to help the bacteria to feed off it. So the bacteria need the green tea, which contains all these lovely polyphenols that they feed off, but it also needs the sugar. And so because it's eating the sugar, it's then creating byproducts and getting rid of a sort of metabolizing a lot of the sugar before you actually drink it. So although it does contain sugar, it's especially if you make this yourself, you're not actually drinking a very, very sugary drink at the end of it, is my understanding. But you're, I have to say, Siobhan, you're more of an expert on this than I am, because I've talked to them, you're the one that makes it.
I am. It's interesting how much you learn by actually doing something. It's like having a little laboratory at home. And I have learned so much, but I'm still no way an expert. And when I speak to people, I suppose like Kenny and Emma, Emma's complete nerd on the subject, so she knows far more than me. But I suppose it is lovely to have this idea of a laboratory at home. And it's really helped me understand why doing research into kombucha, you just think, well, how difficult could it be? You get a whole load of people, you give them kombucha, you find out if their blood sugar goes up and down, if their blood pressure goes up and down. But this a medium is so complex. So when you look at a bottle of kombucha, especially if it's home brewed, what you've got is this really complex bottle of chemicals that's forever dynamically and rapidly changing. So you have your SCOBY, so that's the gelatinous jelly type material that sits on top. And that's got really complex. It was called a tea fungus in China. And that's doing the fermenting by multiple pathways, producing, you know, hundreds of different products, which are constantly changing. And there's so many different bacteria and fungi in your SCOBY, and your SCOBY will be different from my SCOBY. So you can see already how complex it is. Then also you've got the tea. Now everyone thinks, well, how complex is tea? Well, it's incredibly complex. You've got amino acids, you've got vitamins, you've got minerals, but you've also got these other bioactives, particularly these polyphenols you were talking about. Now there's hundreds of thousands actually of plant polyphenols, but the ones in tea, the ones that I spoke about mostly are these flavanols. So they have got crazy complex names, catechins, epicatechins, gallate, what else is there? Theoflavins, theorubigins. You can see how complex it is. Now, they are also dynamically and constantly changing as well. And it's those polyphenols that are meant to have the antioxidant effect. But when we're looking at all the potential health benefits, then which are things like antioxidant, anti-cancer, immune modulation. It's meant to lower your lipids. There's talk about it lowering your blood pressure and blood sugar. And also it's antimicrobial because you're creating this medium which has got a very acidic, low pH, which is really toxic to pathogenic bacteria. So when people sort of say, well, you know, you're brewing this thing, why isn't it full of pathogenic bugs? It's because it's, you know, acts as an antimicrobial, kills them off. Now, there's lots of evidence, as I said, in animal studies and in cell studies for all these things, but there's hardly any, well, it's one or two tiny studies in humans. And again, no one's got the money to be doing these very complex studies unless there's, you know, a commercially a big interest. And also the other thing I was going to say is the conditions. So you may try brewing something at home and I will be brewing something at home, but our conditions are very different. You're in Scotland, maybe your temperature's lower, your pH will be different. You'll be brewing it for a different amount of time. You'll be using different teas. You might use black tea. I'm using green tea. Your sugar source will be different. Your microbes and yeast and bacteria will be different. You know, species will be different. So, you know, it's completely different. And that's why when they're doing studies, it's very difficult to take all those things into account. So they have to know, you know, they have to get it from one source. So all these things make it crazily complex to research.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, isn't it? But just because there isn't the research in it doesn't mean that it doesn't give you health benefits. And I have to say that's one of the reasons why we had this conversation with them, is the reasons behind why they started this company. And Kenny admits that, you know, he was a real guinea pig for Emma because he had irritable bowel. And Emma was giving him kombucha that she'd made herself to help with his irritable bowel. And that's really what started their sort of mutual interest in kombucha, because he felt that that actually made a huge difference to his gut health and his ability to get over his irritable bowel. So, you know, there's lots, we delve into that a little bit more in the conversation, but you know, it's just because there isn't the research out there doesn't mean that there aren't lots of people out there actually getting lots of health benefits from kombucha.
So Sheena, just in case some people don't know about IBS or irritable bowel, can you just give a one-liner on it for any listeners who are not sure what this is or...
Yeah, sure. So irritable bowel is a really common condition. I see an awful lot of it as a GP, and I'm sure you do too. But essentially, irritable bowel is a condition where you don't have a lovely regular bowel motion. You have a bowel that is irritant and reactive, and you might fluctuate between diarrhea and constipation. You might be more prone to diarrhea. You might be more prone to constipation, but you don't have a lovely regular bowel habit, or you might fluctuate in and out of irritable bowel. But essentially, it's created by inflammation within the gut. And we know from all of the reading that we've done in microbiome science that essentially people with irritable bowel have an element of dysbiosis or imbalance in their gut microflora within the large intestine. And this may well drive some of the irritability in that gut. And of course, there are many, many reasons why people can end up with gut, with irritable bowel. From antibiotic usage to infections, to, you know, C-section births and formula feeding disrupting the gut microbiome, and whole host of other environmental factors that can upset the gut microbiome throughout our lifetimes. So there's a whole host of different reasons why people can end up with it. And some people are fortunate enough to get rid of their irritable bowel through lifestyle measures or medications. But some people are sort of stuck with their irritable bowel for lifelong. And we know that irritable bowel can then, you know, be associated with a whole host of other chronic diseases. So, you know, it's not a pleasant thing to have. It's very common out there, a lot of people suffering from it. And I guess, you know, it's good for people to have other means of tackling their irritable bowel. And you and I are certainly, you know, very interested in enhancing the gut microbiome as a way of tackling it.
Yeah, and I think one important point I would say, and I think listening to Emma and Kenny, this comes across, that when they're talking about, Kenny's talking about his irritable bowel syndrome and how it improved with kombucha, there isn't the evidence to be able to say definitely that is proven to help people with irritable bowel syndrome. The studies haven't been done, but it's certainly a safe thing to try. It'd also be fair to say that Kenny admits that he also brought in several other lifestyle measure changes, and he improved his diet in other ways. So it's possible that that was helping as well. So along with becoming interested in the gut microbiome, often you may be drinking kombucha, but you may actually be getting the benefits because you're eating more plant-based whole foods that aren't ultra processed, and you know, sleeping better and not having sweeteners and processed food, which has got lots of, you know, negative additives in it. So it might be those other things as well. So it's often, you know, as you become more interested, you actually start doing other healthier things as well. So
and of course, you know, we know that, you know, just one simple change isn't often sufficient to really enhance your gut gut health. You know, it's very holistic. It responds, you know, your gut health responds to, you know, sleep deprivation, stress, you know, diet, exercise, whole host of different aspects of our life. So you know, even if you make dramatic changes to your diet, if you're still extremely stressed and not sleeping well, then of course you may not get the benefits that you want to get. So you do need that holistic approach. And you know, I do think that when we view gut health, we do have to consider every aspect of your health and when we're trying to enhance it.
I think that's a really good point. In Western medicine, we're so used to having you know, everyone wants a switch that you turn and you're cured. But I think the gut microbiome reminds us that we're an ecosystem, and you need, you know, it's not just a matter of turning, you know, one thing on or off. You have to look at the health of the whole ecosystem. So you're absolutely right. All those lifestyle measures, your sleep, your physical activity, your stress level, and as well as what you eat and drink. So yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to ask you, Shiv, because I have started my kombucha, right? So I'll tell you how far I've got, because I actually had Janice over for some drinks pre-Christmas. So I thought, well, I better get this on, otherwise she's going to tell me off.
Anyone who's listening who doesn't know Janice Klein is this kind of, what would we call her, a fermenting fanatic.
Guru.
Yeah, guru. Who kind of, you know, she's our go-to lady. She does loads of fermenting and she's really, really skilled.
And obviously it was Janice who provided the SCOBY. So this is one of Janice's SCOBYs from her house. And it's, so I didn't realize that she told me that it's actually a green tea SCOBY. So a couple of things with that, which is quite interesting, because I didn't realize that you could get SCOBYs for different types of tea, first of all. And also green tea and black tea, for me, I respond quite differently to those two teas, which is interesting. So I'm going to try the green tea, but I'm not very good with green tea. I'm one of these strange people that when I drink green tea, it actually makes me feel really nauseous. So I'd be really interested to see how I respond to it.
I had no idea there was a different green tea and black tea SCOBY. This is why we need Janice. But to be honest, I would just stick some black tea in it and see what happens. Oh, I'm going to get so many contacts from kombucha specialists. I've probably said something horrendously wrong.
Yeah.
But hey, we want to know. And I'll speak to Janice about it. I have to say that I haven't yet, but I was thinking next time I do a pot of stuff, I might put some black tea in. So yeah, again, you can see that I am not an expert.
Yeah, and didn't Emma say in the conversation that she uses a combination of green and black?
Perhaps
you train your SCOBY into whatever type of tea it is.
And, you know, when you listen to our conversation with Emma and Kenny, I'd like you to really focus, listeners, on the bit where Emma talks about tea, because you can hear her voice lighten and she obviously loves it. They go to this specialist in Manchester and there are these incredible coffee and tea nerds who understand where things come from, the soil, the temperature, the pH of where they're grown, the part of the world they're grown in, the harvest that year. So it's, a wonderful subject when you get into all those sort of tiny nuances. So each year you have a different harvest of tea that has different flavors, and so it's kind of really interesting that they actually go out of their way to try and find the best product for people to use in their kombucha. So yeah, well, obviously I need to do some more reading.
Now Janice told me that it would take 5 to 7 days for the fermentation process.
Well, to even start,
I mean, how did you start that? I mean, I how long do you ferment your green tea SCOBY for?
I leave it. I mean, when I've read different things, they sort of say at least 2 weeks. Although, interestingly, maybe Janice doesn't. But the longer you leave it, more acidic it gets more vinegary. I like that. And again, when you listen to the conversation with Emma and Kenny, Emma likes it when it goes very acidic, Kenny doesn't. So again, it's a taste thing. And I suppose that's quite interesting, isn't it? That when we're trying to work out, you know, the commercial market, there's no good them making a product which Emma loves, which is really sour and no one will drink and it won't sell, because that's not a commercial product. So, you know, you're trying to sort of find out what most people would like. So I like it left on the longer side, and I have left it for 4 or 5 weeks. It gets quite acidic. But reading around the subject, it does seem that actually your polyphenol levels start to reduce after, I think it's about 4 or 5 weeks. So arguably you could say, well, actually you're getting a reduction in the anti-cancer or immune modulation or antioxidant effects if they're due to the polyphenols. But again, no one's able to tease out what the effects are due to, or, you know, how you measure all those things. But I would just go by taste. So if you taste it, in fact, keep a little book beside it or a little piece of paper and taste it at 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and see when you like it. But it's not till after, you know, that's your neutral liquid that you're left with at that time, 3, 4, 5 weeks, that's when you start flavoring it. So I use a lot of ginger. I use a bit of ginger paprika because I like it a bit hot, whereas Janice uses lots of other fruits as well. So you might find that you taste it and you think, oh, it's a bit watery, but it's when you add the other things in, that's when the kind of, the magic begins.
And so when I'm at that stage, when I think it's an okay flavor, I can then take it out of the glass jar that it's in, pop it into a glass bottle, and then add. So when you're adding your flavorings, how do you know how much flavor to add to?
Well, I've only ever done ginger, so I just add loads of ginger. Inch piece of ginger, which I sort of, pulp down and pop in, then leave it in. And then I leave that in for 24 hours and then sieve it. But Janice, I imagine, has got hundreds of different recipes, because I know she uses strawberries and different berries and juniper and, you know, rose hip. And so she'll have 101 other recipes.
You're sieving yours. I don't think she sieves hers. I think she leaves them in the bottle.
I would leave it in the bottle. It's just I'm trying to get my family to have a go and they're already, they just don't like all the bits. So I'm trying to kind of make it as bitless as possible. But anyway, yeah. But if it was me, I'd be happy to leave it in there. Yeah. So it's a matter of taste. Okay. So if we say there's two reasons, you know, if you're looking at the times, it would be a taste issue. It would be a, you know, after a certain point, there are indications that actually any potential beneficial effects for health might start to reduce. Taste might start to go off in terms of it'd be too acidic, so people won't actually like the taste. So it does seem that there's a sort of, you know, certainly up 2 to 4 weeks seems to be the roundabout time that people go for. So I'd be interested if Janice is doing hers less than that.
Well, I wonder if the reason why she's doing it less than that is that she maybe puts it on a heat pad.
Yeah.
So do you have, I mean, do you put yours on a heat pad? Because mine certainly isn't.
No, you see, this is the thing. I'm just like doing it. She will be looking at pH. She'll be looking at temperature. She'll be looking at time. She'll be looking at the types of tea, the sugar source. She will be nerding out on all of it. And she'll probably be taking its temperature, doing regular pHs. I am doing nothing, none of that. I am, you know, doing the basic hygiene things. I make sure everything's, you know, super clean before I start, and, you know, making sure it's covered. So you want oxygen to be allowed in. So you have these kind of muslin, you can make your own muslin or use an old, you know, clean cloth on top of it. So you're trying to get oxygen in, but, you know, trying to avoid getting other bits and pieces in it. So I think I'm at like primary school level compared to Janice. But you know, even at that level, it's great. It tastes good. And, you know, I make loads of it. And yeah, I feel great on it.
And how much do you drink in a day, would you say?
Well, this is an interesting thing. Okay. So I have said before that my family don't want to drink it because, and you'll hear Emma talking about this as well, when you do it at home, she believes that it's the nicest thing to do it at home. And, you know, you and I, we're always trying to give people, you know, excellent advice that's health promoting, that's, you know, more or less zero cost or low cost. And this is definitely the lowest cost way to do it. But we've got to be real. You know, how many people listening now are going to be making their own kombucha? You know, not that many. Lots of people have got better things to do with their time or other things to do with their time. So, and that's why it's quite interesting, because when we started talking to Hip Hop Kombucha, you and I had these conversations about, well, you know, we don't want to be endorsing brands and we haven't got any affiliation with them or any other brands. And we kind of like that. But either we say, well, all commercial drinks and foods are terrible, which clearly isn't the case, because there are groups of people, independent people in the food and beverage world who are really trying to do the right thing and trying to break through and change the, you know, food habits of the nation and produce beautiful health promoting products in the best way that they can. And we've got to be able to sort of tease through and try and work out, you know, how we work out who's doing the right thing and who's not. And as you know, the shelves of the soft drinks aisle are now bulging with loads of other complex drinks, including kombucha. And it's just trying to, you know, work through how someone looks at them and finds out which one's a good one for them to have. And I want to take you back a bit, actually, because this is what struck you when you looked at this drink, particularly because of the sugars. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I'm not a fan of sugary drinks. I never have been. I don't really ever consume them and I don't buy them for my family. You know, we would rarely have sugary drinks. It would be a sort of birthday treat of that. And I certainly wouldn't drink them. But I mean, the sugariest drink I drink is lager, beer. But that's about it. And I don't drink huge quantities of that. So I'm not really into sugary drinks at all. But I kind of made an exception for kombucha because I felt that there was other things about this drink. Despite it containing a little bit of sugar, it was going to benefit me in other ways. And obviously I'm keen on prebiotics and probiotics. And, you know, kombucha contains both. And we've talked about these before, prebiotics being the sort of food for the probiotics, which are the bacteria and the fungi and these microorganisms that are the health beneficial microorganisms. And, you know, both of these things enhance our gut microbiome. So, you know, I'm taking a little journey into this stuff myself. And it's interesting. As I say, I'm not sure about how much to have, because I feel like it's a little bit alien to my gut. So I have to kind of go slow with these things and not overdo it and just have little bits of kombucha here and there. And the other thing is I have this slight aversion to green tea. So I do wonder whether I should stick to black tea kombucha. And then, and so, you know, everybody's gut's different. So, you know, everybody needs to do their own experimenting with these things. And of course, you know, the commercially produced kombuchas do contain more sugar than the ones that you would create yourself. And they won't contain the same quantity of probiotics because they're commercially driven. And we'll talk about that in the interview. So I won't go into that in much detail. But certainly from the sugar content point of view, there is a little bit more in these commercially driven products. So you don't want to be having huge quantities, I don't think. But at the same time, you know more about the impact of that on people in terms of the sugar content, Shiv.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important sort of we place this historically in the sort of food history, sugar sweetened beverages. So that's cans of, you know, sweet drinks that have been sort of around all over the supermarket's shelves that we're trying to get our kids to stop drinking are kind of kiss of death no-no. You know, we're trying to reduce them. They seem to be, you know, they're very calorific, they're very bad for health in many ways. And there's been, you know, a massive surge in increase in particularly younger generations drinking these sugar sweetened beverages and having terrible longer term impacts on their health. So kind of in my head, I had put canned drinks that you get in a supermarket kind of as a no-no. And it's kind of interesting just trying to revisit that and pick it apart a bit and look at the nuances. And particularly going back to what you said about a dry bar, you and I know that alcohol use disorder is a huge problem in the UK and globally. And lots of people really struggle with alcohol intake and excess, and its terrible effects on health and behaviours. So lots of people are trying to move away from alcohol, and it's important for people to have options when they go out for a drink or when they're sort of enjoying a social occasion that doesn't make them look, you know, a bit, you know, or feel out of place. So if you know, go out, it's nice to be able to order a drink like this, which you know is not alcoholic and probably neutral or beneficial for your health. It's a really attractive package. They've put a lot of work into the art and marketing. And, you know, although we might say, well, you know, it still costs money, so we shouldn't be endorsing it in any way, I sort of see on balance that there are lots of functional foods and drinks that are good for your health that we probably do need to be looking at more. And you going back to the sweetened stuff, I mean, the amounts of sugar are low, but they don't add any artificial sweeteners. Now tell us a bit about that, Sheena, because you have never in your childhood, remember we've spoken about this, my idea of a healthy drink for many years has been a zero calorie, I won't say the name, it rhymes with oak, you know I just, as a medical student, I used to have about like 6 or 8 cans a day. I mean, God. You know, and that's, I considered that. Huh? I know. Well, I know it's crazy, but it's just like, maybe not that many. But, you know, and it's sort of in, I thought, well, those are fine. So tell us a bit about that, about these sugar sweetened beverages or artificially sweetened drinks and where we are with that in the sort of health landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have to say, I've always, always been highly suspicious of sweeteners. From a very early age, whenever I came into contact with sweeteners myself, drank a sweetened drink or ate something with sweeteners in it, I would develop quite a severe headache. So it really caused me a lot of side effects. And I didn't like that aftertaste in my mouth. And I didn't like the cloying kind of odd texture in my mouth after eating something that was sweetened. So I was always quite suspicious of sweeteners. My parents were very anti-sweeteners because they're into everything natural. And for them, sweeteners were very unnatural and factory driven. And as such, you know, we didn't really have anything with sweeteners in our house. You know, when the initial studies came out about sweeteners, I was very interested to learn more about them and you know, to work out what they were actually doing to us. And you know, I have been highly concerned about them, especially now because, you know, we're at a stage now where we know enough about them that we realize that they do cause harm. They cause harm to the gut microbiome. They also are, you know, driving metabolic ill health. So they increase your likelihood of diabetes and weight gain. And actually, WHO very recently removed sweeteners as a recommended way of losing weight. They now recognize that sweeteners cause weight gain, not weight loss. So sweeteners are not good for us. And I think, you know, we ought to be very aware of that nowadays. And you know, the companies that produce sweetened drinks have been, you know, making an absolute fortune on us for a long, long time. And I think they're responsible really for helping to drive the obesity pandemic that we're seeing at the moment. And, you know, it concerns me that so many people are quite addicted to sweeteners because sweeteners just obviously are stimulating our sweet receptors in our gut so much that, you know, they're driving that need for constant sugars and sweeteners and in our diet. And the more you drink, the more you want to drink them. And of course, they're highly addictive. And everybody that I know that consumes sweetener drinks doesn't just consume one in a day, they will consume multiple sweetener drinks. And you know, they've gone through periods. I had a friend at school, I remember she used to drink 12 cans of Diet Coke in a day. And I just thought that was absolutely crazy. I tended to drink water when I was thirsty. I didn't just drink it, you know, obsessively like that. And I was probably drinking a fraction of the amount of fluids that she was. But I do think that we've got to be so careful. And sadly, recently with the sugar tax, that's driven sweeteners into our soft drinks even more. So, you know, it used to be that your lemonade didn't contain sweeteners, but now they contain sugar and sweeteners because they're trying to lower the sugar in them. So they've added more sweeteners. So it's actually incredibly difficult to find a product nowadays, a drink product, that doesn't contain sweeteners, because it's not in the company's interest to make it purely sugar. They lose money that way. And so when I saw the kombucha product, I was highly suspicious. I was, you know, scouring the ingredient list to make sure that there wasn't any sweeteners in there because I didn't want a headache just before I was going in to present. And I was pleasantly surprised to see that, you know, they share my opinion on sweeteners, and none of their products actually contain any.
Yeah, because and that's not the case with all kombucha products, because some of them have artificial sweeteners, you know, and they would argue, and I understand that as a commercial venture that, you know, people won't buy their product, but that is what makes this group interesting. And it's important for us to remember that, first of all, artificial or sweeteners, and there's loads of them. There's just like, you know, lists and lists and lists of different artificial sweeteners. Some are artificial, some are non-artificial. A lot of them appear to have a negative effect on your gut microbiome composition. And you've got to remember when they first came out many years ago, people didn't even know that the gut microbiome existed. So they were passed through under this GRAS, which is generally recognized as safe label. And they just got into all our food and beverages. So we're kind of having to work backwards here because they've already got the green light. So it's only now that people are starting to look at them in more detail. And it's not in the interests of lots of food and beverage companies to be looking at this too clearly. So, you know, I don't know where the funding is going to come from, but it is a very, very interesting area. And not all of them has been shown to be unsafe. But, you know, maybe that's a matter of time, but it's likely there are heterogeneous groups. So it's likely that some of them will be more detrimental than others. But, you know, working through these vast lists of sweeteners is going to be a lot of work because they are a huge part of our food system globally. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting. So this doesn't have that. So the interesting thing for me, I was kind of thinking, well, okay, there's lots of potential health benefits, one of which I feel is, you know, it being a non-alcoholic drink. You know, you've got the tea polyphenols there, you've got your, you know, prebiotics, symbiotics, postbiotics, you know, we'll talk about those a bit later. But the thing that concerned me was, well, maybe if you're diabetic, that's a concern. But actually, certainly in animal studies, they've been shown to be blood sugar reducing. Even with this, partly because the sugar will be fermented, but it's quite interesting why teasing through why that might be. So why is something that has a bit of sugar in it, why might it be okay, not only to recommend diabetics as a neutral thing, and this isn't proven, so I can't recommend it to anyone at the moment, but I know there's a couple of groups looking at its effect on blood sugars, and if anything, it seems to be either neutral or reducing the blood sugars. So what are our thoughts, you and I, Sheena, about why that might be?
Well, absolutely. It's really interesting because, of course, the way that you metabolize the sugars is really important. So how it's packaged is really important. In the same way that your apple contains lots of sugar, but it doesn't give you a big sugar spike because of the way it's packaged. And when you consume the apple as a whole, you're consuming all the fibers and everything with it, and these byproducts of fiber metabolism, the short chain fatty acids, actually can help to lower sugars. So, you know, it's very interesting. There are so many means with short chain fatty acids that they can affect sugar metabolism, but they can affect it directly by lowering our response to sugar. And of course, there are prebiotics within kombucha and bacteria that we're also consuming in the kombucha, which can have a direct and an indirect effect on that. So I would suspect that the short chain fatty acid production and their impact on sugar metabolism will play a big role in that.
Well, there's certainly the polyphenols, there's evidence about polyphenols and improving insulin sensitivity and short chain fatty acids as well by multiple mechanisms. So, you know, and then you've got sort of, as you say, this matrix containing amino acids, vitamins, minerals. It's you've got the live bacteria and yeast as well. So they'll be having an effect on, you know, on the gut and your response to anything that's coming into the gut. So it's, yeah, a really interesting area. So the only, we've been talking about lack of human studies, but the only one, there's one or two, but the only one that was kind of interesting, but it's so small. Okay, it's Mendelsohn. I'll put the reference in the show notes. Mendelsohn 2023, Frontiers in Nutrition. And the title is Kombucha Tea as an Anti-Hyperglycemic Agent in Diabetic Humans. So this study was small, okay, 12 people. So these diabetics were randomized to kombucha or placebo. So it looked the same, tasted the same. So they were randomized to either for 4 weeks. Then they had an 8-week washout period where no one had any placebo or kombucha. Placebo, by the way, to anyone's listening, would be a drink that looked, tasted and seemed just like the actual product. So like the kombucha, and that it's randomized and the patient would be blind, so they wouldn't know whether they had the kombucha or just the neutral placebo. So they did that for 4 weeks, and they had a washout period where no one had anything, and then they swapped over. So they found that the fasting blood glucose levels were significantly lowered after 4 weeks with the kombucha, but not with the placebo. So they were sort of hypothesizing from this tiny study that it could potentially be an anti-hyperglycemic therapeutic agent. So in subjects with elevated blood sugars at baseline, it seemed to be associated with a significant reduction in fasting blood sugars, and you didn't get that with the other group. So, but this is the first human sort of randomized control pilot study assessing anti-diabetic effects of kombucha. And it's tiny. I mean, you know, or my colleagues and friends at work will go, Siobhan, I'm not interested. 12 people, you know, come back when you've got like 2,000. But again, when you're thinking about who's going to be interested in doing this. But I was really surprised that it wasn't neutral, or, you know, but the actually, it's not only neutral, it's actually, you know, potentially helpful. And this, when we go back to the whole of studies, we disregard general practice. We're not interested in in vitro or in vivo animal studies. We just say, look, tell us when the big human studies come up, and then we'll wake up and be interested. But actually, if we look at those huge body of evidence for those other studies, either in, you know, in labs or with animals and studying diabetic models in animals, there is a lot of evidence looking at these, you know, lowering blood sugar, lowering effects. And there's lots of potential mechanisms hypothesized, and there's, you know, reams of papers that go into it in detail. So it is interesting.
Totally. And, you know, when it comes to evidence base, we know, because we've all got very, very individual gut microbiomes, that it doesn't matter what the evidence base is. It's what matters is in practice what happens with your own gut microbiome and how you respond. Because, you know, for all the wonderful studies that have been done on most of the Western medicines that we have, there are always people that don't respond the way that the study expects them to, or has lots of side effects that the study didn't expect them to get. And that really probably is, you know, partly down to our individual gut microbiomes and the individual way that we each respond to whatever we put into us, whether that be food, medicines, or these kombuchas and other fermented products.
You really reminded me when you were talking about you don't get on with green tea, you know that. So, you know, definitely don't go for green tea. I know people use chamomile and other herbal teas as well. So, you know, that'd be interesting for you to try. But also, you also made the point where if you're slightly sensitive to something or you're using something new, then don't be gung-ho. It's a bit like if you're completely changing your diet, you never have fiber or fruit or vegetable, and you just suddenly put a whole load in, you're going to get, you know, your gut microbiome won't be able to cope with it. You won't have the gut microbiome composition, you know, needs to build up and change slowly. So our advice is to, you know, do things slowly, try and test them, and gradually build up to a sensible dose. But just because something might be beneficial to your health, most things do have a U shape where, you know, if you get up to a certain level, it probably will not be great for you. And I think it's important to remember before people start drinking vats of homemade kombucha every day that, you know, the safety profile is good. It's FDA approved, the Food and Drugs Administration approved in the USA. But, you know, only they're talking about 200 mils or less a day. That's what it's been approved for. So, you know, excessive intake, you always get these people who, you know, like those people who eat just carrots all day and kind of, you know, get sort of toxic carrot overdose. So, you know, you could potentially, it's an acidic drink. You could, if you drank vats of it, get a metabolic acidosis. There has been kind of single cases of illness associated with kombucha, but again, it's difficult for people to tease through. Was it kombucha? Was it something else? Some people might be allergic to one or more of the components in a kombucha that they make. The alcohol range, it's considered alcohol-free, but, you know, if you're very alcohol sensitive, even levels below, you know, 1.5%, or, you know, you might be sensitive to it. And like all foods and beverages that you're preparing in your kitchen, that any poor hygiene, you know, an introduction of pathogens or just not washing everything afterwards and, you know, making sure the glass you're using is clean, all those sensible things you have to be adhered to. So, I mean, the pathogen, you know, levels are low in the kombucha.
I was going to say, yeah. You don't have to be quite so... you know, it's not the same as jam making. Yeah. When you make jam, you really do need to sterilize the jars. When you're making this, you just need to give them a normal wash. Because actually it doesn't have the same risks of contamination because it's such an acidic antibacterial environment. So the risk of harmful strains going in there are pretty slim, actually.
Yeah, they are in the actual kombucha itself. But obviously, if you're then pouring it into a filthy jar and drinking from that, then obviously that is that. But that's why it's interesting, again, when you listen to Ken and Emma, they'll be talking about why they decided in the end to pasteurize. So, you know, that they did try it to keep it live. But actually, there's lots of difficulties. You have to store it in freezers, and then you've got the whole it's very difficult as a commercial product. So that what they're trying to do is balance, you know, what is really healthy with what is, you know, commercially viable, because if they don't make something that people like that tastes nice, then no one's going to buy it and they're going to fold. So, you know, it's this constant balance. So it did, talking to Kenny and Emma, really brought it home to me, the complexities of trying to bring products onto the market and all the loopholes you have to go through and all the difficulties. And, you know, it really is, it's quite complex, isn't it?
It is. It's a complex world. Certainly producing these things on a commercial market like place like that. Yeah, so it's a really interesting conversation. I hope you guys are going to enjoy this. And we've certainly learned a lot from Kenny and Emma and really enjoyed spending time with them down in Manchester in their very funky offices. Have you got anything else you wanted to say before we start the interview?
No, I think we've given everyone a sort of basic idea of what it's going to be about. And yeah, I hope you enjoy it.
Absolutely. So the sound quality might be slightly different because we were recording in their studios with their recording equipment. So hopefully you'll enjoy this and we'll just head off and speak to you next time. Take care. Bye. Tell us how you got here. What is your story behind the development of your kombucha company?
Over to you.
Okay.
That was easy.
Well, we're so used to this now. We've been doing videos and we talk on wherever we talk. And Emma usually leads on it because it sounds better coming from Emma saying we started it because of Kenny's IBS. Yeah.
Kenny's got IBS. Whole world knows about Kenny's IBS. We've talked about it a lot of times. So the business started because I made Kenny some kombucha to help with his IBS. And he absolutely loved it. And it really helped his IBS. And he loved the flavour and the taste. I'd learned how to make kombucha over a decade ago living in the US. Which was a little bit ahead of us at the time in terms of the availability of fermented food, kombucha, kefir, kimchi. I got into it because I love sour, zingy, tasty things. And then I made some for Kenny. He loved it and we saw an opportunity.
Yeah, and it kind of, when you start on that path of gut health, which I did by drinking kombucha, it then starts lots of questions like, why have I got IBS? How has this been caused? And then you kind of look back into your past and you kind of realise, you know, some of the effects of lifestyle on your gut. So, for instance, I look back at my past and, first of all, my mum didn't breastfeed me. She only breastfed me for a very short period of time. It was many years ago. She didn't know about nutrition, so she gave me a bottle. So I think that probably had some sort of effect. Then when I was 21, I got adult acne. I didn't get it as a teen like most people. I got it when I was 21. And so the doctor put me on repeat prescription with antibiotics. And so I was on antibiotics for 5 years. And so that will have destroyed quite a bit of my gut. Through my 20s, I enjoyed a party lifestyle as well. And then you realise that all of these things accumulate. And in fact, before I was 21, I didn't eat vegetables either. Like I just ate completely beige food. It was my first girlfriend who said, I'm not going to be with you until you eat vegetables. Yeah. And so she got me into vegetables. So you kind of look back at your life and you realise that all of these different aspects, any one of those could have contributed to a dodgy gut. And then you get on the path of looking at your gut by starting with something like this, like a can of prebiotic soda or kind of kombucha.
So we're, as you know, both GPs.
Yeah.
And this is an incredibly common problem, IBS. Had you sought medical help or what was your experience of trying to find help? Or you just put up with the symptoms or?
I've done various things like sent my hair off to get analysed for whether I'm sensitive to food. I'd tried various different diets, keto diets, Atkins diets, paleo diets, all of these different diets, and nothing really seemed to fix it. I did FODMAP for quite some time, and I've now come off FODMAP. FODMAP did help. It stopped the bloating, but I wasn't eating any prebiotics at all. And so I've moved away from that now, and I now eat prebiotics, so I'm fine with that. Yeah, tried all sorts of stuff.
Just for listeners who aren't aware of what FODMAP means, it's fermentable oligo disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols.
I'm glad you said it.
So it was just because people, it's something that's fairly new to the UK, but it's sort of started in Monash University in Australia. Yeah. That's where they sort of started it, and they're doing quite a lot of work at it in King's College now. But it's quite a complex diet for someone to follow, and there's not, on the NHS, there's not a lot of dietitians we can refer to, but they really make it clear in Australia at Monash University, you cannot do this alone. You know, it's kind of, you know, 6-8 week program with a dietitian, and it's sort of quite complex. And my concern about it is you're cutting out a lot of excellent foods, you know, onion and garlic and, you know, all these sort of fermentable fibers, and people sort of cut them all out, aren't sure if it helps, and then stay off it.
Yeah.
So, and in fact, they've done quite a lot of work on the gut microbiome with FODMAP diets as well. And they say it can be really good for some people, but you're meant to find out which food causes the problem and reintroduce all the others, because you don't want to be cutting out loads of fruit and veg. But they have done studies on the gut microbiome with people on FODMAP diets, and you do get quite depletion. You do get reduction in diversity. Mm-hmm. They don't know, people who argue, does that matter? They haven't done the studies to see what the longer term health effects of that can be. But I suppose, yes, anything where you're reducing diets. So it's our concern with lots of diets, isn't it, Sheena, that when you're sort of doing restrictive diets without help from an expert nutritionist, that people just start restricting, that doesn't work, so they add restrict something else, and then they've restricted to such a degree that they're micronutrient deficient and they're not feeding their gut microbiome.
And that is the key, getting help, because I just did it on my own. You've seen me. Downloaded the app, the Monash University app, and anything that was high FODMAP, I probably did it for about a year, just cut it out.
Wow.
Completely.
And that's interesting, because with FODMAP, the longer you do it for, the more depletion you get of your gut microorganisms, yes, the beneficial ones in the gut. And so it can actually be quite damaging for your gut microbiome. And in some cases, people with IBS have depleted these microorganisms for such a long time that they then can't get them back.
Yeah.
And that can be an issue, and it can trigger sort of long-term, quite severe IBS. So it's a worry, actually, when people are doing these diets on their own. But it's also, I mean, I have to say, I've even seen people in the medical who are being medically supervised who have continued these diets for too long. So I think sometimes we're a bit gung-ho in the medical profession sometimes with these diets as well.
I just want to add there quickly, Sheena, sorry to interrupt, with anyone who's listening who is on a FODMAP diet, there's an incredible amount of research. It can be really, really excellent for some people. So if you're out there and you're listening and you're thinking, oh my goodness, I'll stop my FODMAP, everyone says, all the nutritionists, all the dietitians, Monash University, it has to be with someone who is trained in FODMAP, because it's really complex, and there's some brilliant people out there. And, you know, if you sort of look at what King's College are doing. So we're not saying, and that's the whole thing about the gut microbiome, isn't there? There isn't any right or wrong. It's getting the right information.
Yeah. So tell us, Emma, what was your driver? I mean, it's one thing introducing a friend to kombucha and, you know, making that yourself. It's quite another creating a company out of this. So what was your driver for that?
So a few different reasons. I personally love food. I love good food, and I'd love the taste of it. I was really interested in building a business in that. We were both interested in the health side of things, and obviously Kenny's outlined his story. I'm really lucky. I've got a pretty hardy gut, I think, and can kind of generally eat most things and don't have much of an issue. We've both got families. I'm really driven by wanting to give my kids and my family really good food. So it was really interesting to have a business in that. We looked at what was going on abroad. So in America, where I'd come back from, where, as I think I mentioned before, this sort of food and drink was definitely on the rise. We could see what was going on in Australia, in Canada. So from a business perspective, we thought there was an opportunity. We started off quite small scale. So we were making it in my, first of all, literally in my kitchen and then in the garage. So the kombucha that you're drinking right now, the culture that's in that was the original culture that was on my kitchen table, and we've just looked after it and grown it and nurtured it. So it's pretty cool that all the kombucha in the cans comes from that original source. We love fermenting stuff. I love, as we've got to know more about it, the microbiology of it, it's a pretty cool thing to make. It's quite a challenging thing to make, because it's living and you've got to sort of learn how to manage that. Luckily, we've got people working for us now who are professionally trained and have a background in brewing and microbiology and stuff like that. And there's no kombucha school. It's not like beer where you can, you know, go to beer school. I've been to beer school for a week to help me learn about brewing. But for us, it's very much learning as you go, growing the industry.
Yeah, there was at the time as well, there were very few kombucha brewers out there that were kind of willing to share. It was kind of like a secret sauce thing. Adam from Jar was really good, wasn't
yeah,
he? He'd been in it for quite a few years and he helped with quite a lot of stuff. But generally, the beer world, there's so many beer brewers and so much information on the internet, it's very easy to set up a beer brewery, but it was pretty difficult for us at the start.
Yeah, and similarly, I mean, we should say that we started out as a kombucha brewery. Now we're a functional, got health drinks brand, so we don't just make kombucha, we make sodas. So we've got a soda that has apple cider vinegar in it. We call that our living soda. Then we've got a soda that's got fibre in it. And again, learning how to make those drinks when they're quite new has been quite challenging at times, because we think there's quite a lot of functional drinks that don't actually taste very nice. The biggest thing for us is making a drink that's a pleasure and that tastes good, because otherwise why would people go back to it? So it's been quite, we spend a lot of time with our head brewer developing recipes, testing things out. We've got a testing team. So Kenny's wife Kate was on, I always get this bit wrong, BBC
Food and Drink.
Food and Drink. So she was the drinks expert. And so we get her, and she's got a wine business, and they've her team are WSET qualified. So we get them to test the drinks and tell them, you know, they give us feedback. And because the data shows, actually, I think there was a Mintel study that found that when people are choosing a healthy drink, for 75% or 80%...
76.
He's the marketing guru. But for those 76% of people, taste is still the most important aspect of the drink, even, you know, over and above the health benefits. So the challenge is making a drink that tastes good, that is healthy, that balances sugar content and things like that.
Yeah, so if you look at, you know, many kind of drinks out there, they're kind of more like a project. Whereas for us, it was important that we got the health side sorted out as well, but the taste was really important as well, because, you know, we'd looked into the research and taste is just so important to people. And we had all of these experts on hand to help us as well.
This reminds me of that whole live yogurt market. You know, when you're in the supermarket, you don't know what to get, and you've got those sort of small artisan people doing the right thing and creating these lovely yogurts, and then you've got sort of big people making big claims, and it's really complex. I was not going to say for lay people, it's really complex for medics as well, who will know less than an interested layperson, someone who's looked at food and supplements and fermented food and has learned about it. You know, there's none of that at medical school. It's very confusing when you add to that the confusion now that's coming with ultra processed food and people saying, well, look, anything in a tin, anything that's wrapped up in any way should stay away from. It's very complex for people to try and separate something in a can. And can I just say, I love your designs. You've taken a lot. It's just very nice that you've done, you know, such beautiful artwork, and it just shows how much you love your product. But okay, I have a confession to make. I do my own kombucha, and you very kindly sent us a few cans of your drink, which are absolutely delicious, but I'm slightly cross because no one at home will drink my kombucha. So I was given a SCOBY for Christmas, and it's turned to this kind of monster plate size thing. It doesn't look, they're not pretty SCOBYs. So if anyone's listening, I would describe a kind of big, thick, gelatinous, kind of creamy, mushroomy sort of jelly thing. It looks like a jellyfish, essentially.
Looks like an alien.
It does look like an alien, but I've become quite, you know, my husband's going to throw it out, and I go, you know, it's a little bit, you know, it's the SCOBY or you, you know. So they, when your drinks arrive, they drink, it's lovely, it's delicious, I love this, it's really nice. And they won't drink mine, I feel a bit put out, really, because I've got these little stringy bits in it. Mm-hmm. So tell me about that and what you have to do, what the difference between, because we would always say to patients, you know, because we're conscious of people's, what they can afford, and we want people to do really simple, cheap things at home with fermented food and doing their own kombucha to try and boost their fermented food. So how would you explain that to people? So tell me a bit about your thoughts about why you've put a lot of thought into it. This is healthy and it's very different from another canned drink.
Okay, so first of all, I would say that I think, and I probably shouldn't say this because I own a drinks business, but the best kombucha anyone's ever going to drink is the stuff that they make themselves at home. It is.
Well, it's the same with food, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the same.
I think that's right to say that.
Yeah.
And so that's why we do workshops and we teach people how to make their own kombucha. I love the stringy bits. And I love it when it turns into vinegar and it kind of takes the roof of your mouth off. I think that's delicious. The vast majority
I hate that.
I'm not into that. So we spent a lot of time figuring out what sort of taste profile people like. So we know that we can't ferment, we can't take it too far because if it's vinegary, then people won't drink it.
I'm a good barometer. I like things like Emma loves spicy and really sour stuff, whereas me, I'm a little bit more plain. So if I like it, then the general populace will like it.
So we filter the drink to take any stringy bits out because we know that people don't like stringy bits and they don't like blobs floating around in their drink. We look at the sugar content. We were having a conversation before we sort of started broadcasting, weren't we, about how I've read a lot of things lately where in the press and nutritionists are saying avoid something that says low sugar or low calorie. Now, for us, we need to shout out about the fact that we're low sugar and low calorie. We managed to achieve that without putting sweeteners in, for example, and we still have a good tasting drink because that's what people are looking for. So from a marketing point of view, we need to get people to pick up our drinks and take a look at them. I think commercially, in terms of producing the drinks, if we're going to scale this business, produce drinks that taste good and that do good, we can't make kombucha like you make kombucha at home. It just doesn't work commercially. So, for example, to stabilise our drink, we pasteurise it. Now, pasteurisation is a bit of a dirty word in fermentation land. And you'll see lots of stuff where people are saying if it's pasteurised, then it's bad. They've killed all the stuff. There's nothing good about it. That's not true. So we pasteurise our drink to stabilise it. We used to be cold chain, and what we were finding was the drinks were leaving the brewery. Even though you write all over it, keep refrigerated, people weren't keeping it refrigerated. So we were in bottles, we had exploding bottles, you get exploding cans. When the drinks are fermenting in the container, the yeast, so kombucha is extremely volatile. Like, it's quite a difficult drink to work with. It's the challenge and the beauty of it, but it's pretty volatile. So one of the things we found that if it was left in a cupboard, then the yeast would go crazy. And then you get off flavours from the yeast, so you take the lid off and it smells of sulphur and that, you know, that kind of eggy smell, because you can't control what's going on in the bottle. Also, some kombucha companies produce their kombucha in different ways to make it stable. So some will do completely cold chain.
Which means it has to be refrigerated every step of the way.
So they're the problems that I've just outlined that we were finding. And the UK is not America. The UK is not set up to have masses of cold chain everywhere. We don't have huge fridges. The kombucha, you sell your kombucha to a cafe or a bar and they can only fit six of them in a fridge because we're tiny. We don't have massive walk-in fridges. Obviously, there's the sort of environmental aspects that come with that as well, because you can't, it's expensive, you've got to keep stuff refrigerated, it's not transportable. Already talked about the way that the product changes. Other kombucha companies will make a kind of kombucha blended drink that's got a super fermented kombucha vinegar in it, and to make it palatable it needs some sweetness. Now if you added sugar into the can, then you'd create the fermentation, you'd have all the problems that I just outlined. So what they will do instead is add sweeteners. We don't like sweeteners because we don't think they taste very nice. Like, even the natural sweeteners, they've got a bitterness to them that kind of hits the back of your throat. So all the things that we were talking about taste before, that gets compromised. And also we're seeing more and more studies looking at the impacts on sweeteners. And I know the jury's out on them and artificial versus natural sweeteners, but from what we've seen, sweeteners are not good for your gut. Bacteria don't eat sweeteners. It's from the, you know, the, and I'm not a medic or a scientist. I'm a lay person who's interested in it and has a business in it. But from the reading around that we've done and the research we've looked at, sweeteners trick you into craving more sweet stuff, and also they upset the balance of the microbiome. So why would we want to produce a gut healthy drink that's got sweeteners in it? Like, we don't want to do that. So building a drinks business so that it commercially is a success means you have to decide how you're going to make it and make some carefully chosen compromises, but stick with your principles. So for us, our principles are that we're not going to use sweeteners ever. We don't agree with those. We want the products to be natural. We want to brew the product traditionally, because the other thing with kombucha is everyone thinks kombucha probiotics. That's really important. That's why we add a probiotic bacteria to our drinks. And I can come back to that and talk about that in a little more detail. But there are lots of other benefits to kombucha that people are less aware of. So the fact that it's made from tea. So ours is a blend of green and black tea, and we use the most beautiful loose leaf green and black tea, like it. And we buy it from a tea merchant in Manchester, and he's lovely. And he knows where the tea's coming from, down to the corner of the field, and he works with growers and families. And we spend a big chunk of money actually on making sure that we get the best quality tea, because then when you brew it and you use big leaves, you get better extraction and it unfurls in the brew. And so all the beautiful stuff about tea, all the antioxidant benefits, whether it's, you know, even if kombucha is pasteurized, that's still in there. Then during the fermentation, you get all the byproducts of the fermentation process itself. So there's the antioxidants in the tea, but then that gets enhanced in the fermentation. So the acetobacter that are in our culture are producing acetic acid, and there are lots of benefits to do with acetic acid. I know in terms of how it impacts upon blood glucose, for example, and I guess it depends how much acetic acid is in the final product as the effect that has, but acetic acid and gluconic acid and all the other things that are going on kombucha are in the drink, and are antioxidant and beneficial. And I've read lots of different studies about the impact of gluconic acid on your liver, etc. So there's all this beautiful
just to point
stuff.
Out those are short chain fatty acids, what, you know, Siobhan and I are keen to go on about quite a lot, these byproducts. And so you might have heard us talking about short chain fatty acids in the past,
which is a postbiotic, right? Right?
So, yes, it's considered alongside the bacteria as postbiotic.
Yeah, so there was a lot of controversy about whether, so the ISAP, when they came out their 2021, I think their definition of a postbiotic, I think you're right. The only thing you have to have in a postbiotic, for anyone who's listening and thinking, right, I don't know what they're talking about, there's this whole new area of biotics. So biotics just means life, and everyone knows about antibiotics. So when you kill the bacteria, then there's all these other things as well. There's probiotics, which are live bacteria, which are beneficial to health. Then there's prebiotics, which are like food to feed your beneficial bacteria, and that has to be proven to be good for health. Then there's synbiotics, which is a combination of both. We're nearly there, for anyone who's confused. Emma's just mentioned this new kid on the block, which is postbiotics. Well, sounds a bit like some sort of, you know, trendy film or something. Anyway, postbiotics. So they are dead bacteria, but they plus all the molecules they produce. But in the definition, they said all they want for proof is the dead bacteria, but they said there are lots of other things. But you can see the complexities of doing research in this area. I mean, as you know, there's very few studies on kombucha. Mm-hmm. Human studies have done a few cell, well, quite a lot of cell studies and animal studies. Plus, you've also mentioned tea. I mean, that's a whole beautiful area in itself, and there's been a lot more work done with that. So you've got all this polyphenols and catechins in tea, which are these brilliant sort of chemicals, all these vitamins, all these minerals. So all these beautiful, you know, bioactives that most of us have never heard of. It's just this incredible sort of wonder world of all these new, you know, chemicals that are really beneficial for health. And then you've got all the kombucha stuff as well. So it's just mind-bogglingly complex to break it down and work out what's doing what. And also we all, you know, react differently to different drinks. So plus, who's going to be spending a lot of money doing research on kombucha and fermented food? No one, you know, big pharma aren't going to be interested.
And, mm-hmm. and my understanding is that with the kombucha, obviously you're adding sugar as a source of mm-hmm. nutrient for the bacteria. But in actual fact, the bacteria also utilize the polyphenols in the teas and they ferment those. And, you know, that's what goes on in your gut when you drink tea or coffee. The polyphenols in these actually travel into your large intestine because they're not absorbed through your small intestine. Most of them, they travel into your large intestine and they stimulate the growth of all these beneficial microorganisms. And actually, the beneficial microorganisms ferment these products and they create more short-chain fatty acids and interesting byproducts. And they're highly antioxidant, as you say, and antioxidant things actually really protect us from cancers. So they get rid of all the sort of toxins from our systems. And so they're really beneficial in that way. So product like kombucha obviously has that benefit of the antioxidants and also the live bacteria if you're creating it yourself in your kitchen, and then the short chain fatty acids as well. So obviously with your product, you're not having the live organisms, but postbiotics, these dead microorganisms and their short chain fatty acids that they've already produced while in the fermentation process have been shown to exert similar health effects, which is why they're now a very interesting and popular way of producing a health product, because drug companies are now looking at producing a lot of postbiotics now because they're much easier to produce them than probiotics. So that's a sort of growing and emerging area of supplementation in the pharmaceutical companies now as well. So you mentioned that it's not much evidence base for kombucha. Do we know of any evidence base for kombucha at all?
Can I just say, I know I'm butting in, I can't help it, Emma, just to correct something that you said, Sheena, because you said that you know that the drink has no bacteria or that it's been pasteurised. However, Emma has added explain that to us. So mm-hmm. what have you done there?
So there isn't, you're right, there are some studies into kombucha, but they're very kind of limited. And also there's no studies into the viability of, no serious studies into the viability of the bacteria and yeast in kombucha and how it travels through the body. Like, does it survive the stomach acid, for example? So we and some other drinks companies and other kombucha companies add a bacteria called Bacillus coagulans. So that's been proven to be able to get through the digestive tract. It's a spore bacteria. So it comes through and then it spores in the gut. So we add that because we looked into it and we wanted to find something that had been tested and proven into the drink. So we've still got that live component in there and all the other attributes that you just articulated then.
So what about the dose of that? I mean, that's one I've not heard of. I have to, you know, this gets very complex once you start looking at all the names, all these bacteria. I mean, thousands of them, aren't there?
Is it lactobacillus coagulans or is it bacillus? Yeah.
Bacillus coagulans.
Yeah. So tell us about that then. And how do you know, is that one that's commonly used in kombucha? And how do you know what? So if you were saying that your drink was probiotic, I'm presuming you're not allowed to unless it's been proven to have health benefits. But also they would want to know,
you can't make any claims about probiotic.
In the UK, you can't. In America, you would be able to call it probiotic. But do you think it's the same in Australia as well?
The dose of this bacillus in
So we've tested it and we have, there's some variation because it's a live product, but we're looking to have around a billion per cup.
So there are scientific studies out there that has shown that it supports people with IBS and also has an effect on mental health as well. It's worth, I can send you some links after this.
That'd be interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think there are a few studies coming, a few human studies on diabetes and kombucha and glucose control, because there is this interesting thing where people would say, well, I don't want to give this to a diabetic. It's got sugar in it. The mantra has been go for something with artificial sweeteners, go for a, you know, diet soda.
Until recently,
Sheena's not
WHO have turned around on that. Yeah. They have now said that they no longer recommend sweeteners for anybody to lose weight with. So that's now a big turnaround, actually, from the WHO on sweeteners. So that's worth knowing.
That includes the natural ones like stevia as well, doesn't it? Yeah.
I mean, it's a very, when you start mentioning sweeteners, I mean, just so many of them. And, you know, it's very, there's lots of nuances about when people tend to say, well, the artificial ones are bad and the natural ones are good. But it's very, very complex. They're trying to test them now because all these came into play when no one even knew about the gut microbiome. And it was generally recognised as safe and everyone just, you know, ticked the box. And so all these things are now in all our foods and drinks. And it's only recently that people are doing studies showing that they are very detrimental, not only to your gut microbiome composition, but also to the, you know, intestinal wall and your inflammatory levels. But it would only be fair to say it hasn't been proven in all of them. I mean, I have to say, when they looked at emulsifiers, a lot of them, the majority of them were very detrimental. But, you know, I'm not an expert in this area, and I know that not all of them are seen as negative to the gut microbiome. We know in the tests that they've done, but you were right that you mentioned they do feed up to the brain and they do something weird, increase your appetite rather than reducing your appetite. And there's all sorts of strange
gene manipulation.
Yeah.
So it's tricky, isn't it? Because we've all been conditioned that sugar is bad.
Yes.
Sugar is bad. Bad, bad, bad. That's the kind of overwhelming thing we get told about in the media and stuff. And sugar is natural and we're meant to eat, so like everybody needs to eat some sugar, right? The issue is that a lot of the time we're consuming more of it than we should. Sugar is essential to a kombucha fermentation. I think you mentioned before, that's what powers it. You can't feed bacteria sweeteners. You need sugar. And I think we try to not be preachy about stuff. And a little bit of, you know, our drinks do have sugar in them. That's one of the reasons why they taste nice, because they do have a natural plant-based product in them that's not a sweetener. I think what we've tried really hard to do, and I think we've achieved it, is produce a drink that is working with a natural ingredient and has a sweetness to it, but it's still very low sugar comparatively. You know, there's way less sugar in this than there is in a full fat, not to be mentioned, other soda, or even, you know, the diet sodas that you've got that have, they say they've got 4.9 grams of sugar per 100 mil in them, and then they've got loads of sweeteners in as well, because you're trying to...
It's even low for a kombucha.
Yeah, some kombuchas are a lot higher than us. And I think, and my children love this stuff, and it's about, as, and I think it's getting more easier as more foods and drinks like this become available, it's about educating people's palates and getting people used to eating and drinking things that aren't quite as sweet or overly sweet.
I'm sure you'll talk about sugar in a minute, but as I tried to allude to at the beginning, you know, what we want to be is that kind of first step into people trying something that is going to be beneficial to the gut and not bad to the gut, which is what it was for me. We're not saying this is going to cure your IBS. Like you mentioned before, the best way to do that is to work with a nutritionist and get a proper plan in place.
Yeah, we're one part of a overall balanced diet. You were talking about restricted diets before. Mm-hmm. I just think moderation is key, isn't it? And having a wide range of different food and drinks, and our drinks can form one part of that. Yeah. And there are different other sort of benefits to them, or other sorts of drinks like ours. I'm trying to not drink very much. I'm trying to not drink much at all, much alcohol. And actually having some of these in the fridge and just... So last night I was telling Kenny, I did a kimchi making workshop actually last night with a group of people. I did this workshop and I got home and the house was a disaster because the kids had trashed it. And I had to clean up after this workshop and it was like 10 o'clock at night. And I was thinking, I just really fancy a glass of wine. And I stopped myself from having a glass of wine and I had one of these instead. And just that little alternative, something that's interesting, something that's a bit more complex than a lime and soda or whatever, even that is a good thing. And that little bit of sugar.
And what interested me, because I'm not a soft drink person, soft drinks are generally not in my house. I've never really drunk them myself. And it would essentially be something that we would only have in the house for a birthday or a celebration. But my children, of course, given the opportunity, would love to have fizzy drinks and very much take every opportunity they can get on holiday or, as I say, celebrations. And I would sort of be despairing looking at the soft drinks that are available in the shops and checking out all the ingredient lists and thinking, my God, I actually don't want them to have any of these. I don't want them to have all of those artificial things that are inside them. And I don't want them to have lots of sweeteners. I'm choosing the sort of full-fat Coca-Colas, which are so packed full of sugar. And I'm not happy with it. And I thought, you know, when I saw that you provide soft drinks without the caffeine that have much, much less sugar and don't contain sweeteners, but in addition, they contain fibre, which is wonderful, and these postbiotics, that was actually a revelation for me. And I gave them to the kids and they actually loved them. I thought, oh, that's wonderful, because it gives somebody like me an option for the kids that I'm more comfortable with as a sort of treat, because they love it and I love it. And I feel like I'm not actually destroying their gut with the soft drinks. So that is where I'm coming from with this, because I'm not generally a drinker of soft drinks, but I appreciate what you've done with your company to provide an alternative to what's currently on the market.
So my house is much trashier than Megan's over here. But interestingly, what I do have in my house is a teetotal husband who's just never drunk. And, you know, when you go out, it is pretty limited. Plus, Sheena only found out the other day, because she saw me when we were chatting on Zoom, and my daughter brought me in a can of, it rhymes with oak, and it's a diet drink. Diet. And she was really upset because she's read all this stuff about, you know, I'm drinking this drink, which is bad for my gut, and I'm a microbiome medic, and I've let the side down. But interesting, though, you've got to sort of look at it in a cultural terms. That was considered a health drink.
Yeah.
And kind of still is, being so well marketed, that actually it's really, and women particularly, you know, where they're sort of, they're very weight conscious, and we've been told that this drink keeps you slim, or even if it's a bit, but the evidence is pointing otherwise, that, you know, the people who are drinking these diet sodas, actually they aren't losing weight, and possibly it might even be adding to the obesity epidemic. So for me, with a teetotaler in the house, and he really, you know, it's cool, it's fun, and I know that you were asked to do that sort of no alcohol bar, I suppose when, as microbiome medics, we're sort of saying that this is kind of really interesting product, we're not suggesting that everyone, I mean, all these things are beautifully made and expensive. No one can afford to do this, but have them all the time. I'm sure your kids are now going to want them, but you'll have to put a limit on them. It's a sort of a special drink for me. Obviously,
I would say we're probably not much more expensive, but it's more expensive because of the things that I mentioned before, the quality of the ingredients. Often it's from a smaller company like us, and we make everything ourselves, and we've got to, you know, to brew kombucha starter, it sits in a tank for a month. It's not something we can churn out really quickly. So we've got to, you know, pay for stuff to sit in a tank for a period of time. Lots of different reasons why it's a little bit more expensive. We do things like subscriptions so people can buy in bulk and try and reduce the cost. We've actually got a number of customers who previously to drinking our stuff had an addiction to the diet drink that rhymes with oak, literally drinking 5 and 6 cans of it a day, and drinking our stuff has helped wean them off that, which I think is a pretty cool thing to do. And yeah, just like you were saying before, different opportunities for drinks. My son had his friends around at our house in the summer holidays, and they're like, yeah, Jake's mum, can we try one of your drinks? So they all went off with they were drinking the sodas, and then the leavers do we had, they're going, well, yeah, Jake's mum, your drink's race, can we have some more? It's really cool when you see kids, just like the kids enjoying them, not necessarily. I would always give my kid a full fat drink rather than the diet ones.
Wow, really?
So yeah, 100% all the time. Yeah, they're not allowed them all the time, but I would, because it's more natural than the other stuff. Yeah,
I think also one thing we don't talk about is like mouthfeel and character. And the thing is, with Coke, it's got so much sugar in it, it has the mouthfeel. Mm. Now, the good thing about kombucha, because it's fermented and it has a complexity to it, has that mouthfeel, similar to alcohol. But also with our sodas, because we've got the fibre in there, it gives it that mouthfeel as well, so you can afford to have much lower sugar.
And the apple cider vinegar drinks that we make, the lemon sodas, they've got this kind of zing to them. Both of the sodas, I think I mentioned this earlier, but they literally took us months. So, for example, with the fibre drinks, we're like, to the team, to our brewing team, like, OK, we want you to create a range of three sodas, which are a cola, a lemonade and an orangeade. And they need to be low in sugar. They need to have this much fibre. We're not using sweeteners, like particularly with cola. That must have gone through about 50 iterations because it was so hard to make.
And it's still a bit like Marmite, that one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's funny, that one. It is like Marmite. People either love it or they hate it.
The cola.
Because I think people are so conditioned to what big brand cola tastes like that if they don't get that, some people they're just expecting the big brand taste and they're not getting it. Whereas other people, I don't drink cola. I don't, and I'm full fat. I don't like that sugary. You know when you feel like your teeth are coated? I hate
that. I can't stand that. They
fall out.
It's horrible. I don't like it. And I really love our cola because it's a bit like roller cola.
I love it.
It's like 1950s. It is vintage old school.
And it didn't give me that sugar drop afterwards.
No.
Which I was amazed about, because that's why I wouldn't drink soft drinks like this, because generally an hour or two later, I'm dying. I'm just, so lethargic, so tired and feeling like starving hungry because my sugar has plummeted. But I didn't get that with this. And that was an interesting thing for me because I don't think any other soft drink has ever done that.
Oh, that's cool.
So that was a revelation. And it must be the combination of fibres in there. I'm just assuming that my metabolism of the sugar is slightly different to not be getting that big sugar drop. But
I did read one study that, you're exactly right, where they sort of looked at postprandial glucose responses after having kombucha as opposed to having other foods and drinks. But you do, because you might expect with a sugar content of any sort, you expect to get a rise. But it does seem that, polyphenols and the dietary fibre and the other contents, not everything to do with the tea as well, does seem to really calm that down.
There's so much going on.
There is so much in the drink.
Things that we've talked about.
And you think of this really complex biochemical profile with thousands of different chemicals in, it's going into your body and all these different receptors are going, sending off all these different messages. It's just everything is so much more complex than we thought. And it's this whole idea of the complexity of food and drinks. People just saying, shall I have fat? Shall I have carbs? Tell me what to do. Shall I have protein? As if that's the answer. But there was one article I read about a clove of garlic's got like 2,600 distinct chemicals in it. So if that has, and then that depends on where it's grown, the soil, the temperature, how long it's left brown for, how long it's cooked for, changes the chemical composition all the time. So that's just one thing. So if you imagine that's just part of what you might put into a meal, we're just talking crazy numbers of crazy biochemistry here. Can I ask you about fibre? Because I was talking to Sheena about your drink, and we've got a thing about people not having enough fibre because it's meant to be 30 grams per day, and people have like 15 grams a day here. So we're really fibre deficient, micronutrient deficient in the UK. But I was pretty amazed by how much fibre is there in one of your cans?
8 grams.
I mean, that's like fibre. And that must be what some people are getting.
Lots of it, because it's about 30 grams a day being recommended to have. And it's actually, because I've tried it, it can be quite hard to get 30 grams a day of fibre into your diet.
So it says on the side of the can a quarter of your daily fibre.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we find it difficult. I reckon we're on 100 grams a day.
Easy.
We're getting we're showing off now, aren't we? Yeah. But if you don't, it has to be said, some people, for whatever reasons, whether it triggers their IBS or they just don't like it, you have to be realistic. I mean, we happen to love that food. Some people don't. And it is interesting that, you've got something without sweeteners that actually has got a 25% of your fibre intake.
If you were to meet my husband, he's obsessed with fibre. So we've been looking at I think every meal, and I bring stuff into work for you quite a lot. I feel like I've helped you on your prebiotic journey.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah.
So I'm always bringing pretty much every meal. I'll eat beans and there'll be some sort of vegetable in there and kale and all sorts of different stuff.
And I'm fine now. Garlic, onions,
because you have to get
beans,
used to it. Your microbiome. If you give it too much straight away, then of course you're going to blow up. It has to be incremental. You have to sort of.
But you do have to think about it and think about how you're going to get it into your meals. All sorts of different stuff. I guess there's the different types of fibre because you need the roughage and the soluble stuff. And it's, I guess it's really, and I just had never until I'd done this, sort of was involved in this work, never thought about the fact that fibre is food for the bugs. Mm-hmm. Like human beings don't digest fibre. Mm-hmm. Like who knew? I didn't know that until a couple of years ago. I love that. Yeah. I just love that there's all these and you're right, the stuff you were saying before about it's really confusing, and it is, there's lots of different advice and sort of contradictory stuff, and
I think you're exactly right. You remind me of my joy when we did a talk about cesarean sections and breast milk, and it was about human oligosaccharides in milk, that actually mother makes 200 or more different types of these HMOs just for the baby's bacteria in the gut, not even for her baby. And we were like blown away that nature has sort of provided for the gut microbiome in that way. It was kind of, you know, it's that lovely idea that actually we're meant to be feeding the gut microbiome.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, guys. That's been really, really interesting. And I've learned a lot about kombucha. I might even consider making some at home at some stage, or maybe get some little...
Get some scobies
from you. Yeah. So thanks very much for joining us today. I hope everybody's found that really interesting. I certainly have. And we will speak to you all in another month's time. Take care.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Microbiomedics Podcast. We really hope you enjoyed the content and we welcome your feedback. We'd love to hear any suggestions you might have for microbiome topics that you'd like us to cover. And we also appreciate listeners' questions and will endeavour to answer them in the next podcast.
So if you want to progress this learning further, look at the Gut Microbiome for Clinicians. It's an online course on bslm.org.uk, which will take you on a much deeper dive into the gut microbiome.